Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Garrod Connolly is the author of the New York Times bestselling memoir, Boy Erased. Connolly returns with a deeply moving story of faith and love in his debut novel, All the World Beside. Connolly has coined it the queer scarlet letter. Garrod Connolly is the bestselling author of the memoir, Boy Erased, as well as the creator and co-producer of the podcast, Unerased, The History of Conversion Therapy in America. It's a great pleasure to welcome Garrod Connolly to this week's book show. Garrod, thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Joe.
What brought you to want to tell this particular story in this particular time frame?
If I'm honest, it was a dare from my husband many years ago, I guess like 6 or 7 years ago, after Boy Erased had come out. He said, well, what are you going to do next? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, what if you wrote about queer Puritans? And I laughed because, first of all, I thought that was such a dare, you know, to do the research to talk about identities that, you know, we can't really look back on history and say gay, straight, bisexual, et cetera. Those identities are newer terms that we use. So how do we search for ourselves in the past was really how this began. And then, you know, I kept going home to Arkansas, where my dad is a missionary Baptist preacher. And though our relationship is strained, I would end up talking with him for a long time about theology. He was really into the 18th century minister, Jonathan Edwards, who some of your listeners might know from his very famous Fire and Brimstone sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, where he compares our souls to spiders dangling over an open flame. It's very terrifying. But Jonathan Edwards was actually much more interesting than that. He was raised in that kind of Enlightenment, Yale thinking. And so he would often deliver really what were lectures instead of sermons. And I became really enthralled by his writing. And my father and I had a lot of discussions about him. And what I learned was really just how different my father's understanding of faith is in his Baptist church from, you know, the Congregationalists back then with Jonathan Edwards. And I just started thinking, well, how did we get here? You know, how did we get to a place where conversion therapy, which was the topic of my first book, Boy Erased, became a reality, something that was conceivable to a current moment. And it all spiraled from there. And then I got inspired to write about this love story between a minister and a physician in his town, and did, you know, quite a bit of research on all of that. And what truly was the most surprising to me was a letter that I found. I'll try to make it radio friendly, believe it or not. It was very racy between these two men in the 18th century. And one of them, Virgil Maxey, which is a gay name if I've ever heard one, he was writing to another man, William Blanding, and he said, you know, sometimes I get to hugging the pillow instead of you. I miss you in the bed. And he said, and then other times I mistake the bedpost for your doodle. And etymologically speaking, when you look that word up, it is what you think it is. And there were some other, you know, much racier moments in that letter that really made me think, okay, well, this plausible deniability that so many straight historians have on the past when these two men are writing letters to each other, it only goes so far. And so the rest has to be done by fiction, by kind of speculation.
When you had the conversations with your father and you said you saw the differences, do you think he saw them as well?
Oh, for sure. I mean, one thing that he's very disturbed by with Jonathan Edwards, and honestly, so am I, is this idea of the elect, which back in the 18th century, most Christians in these territories believed that God had chosen you before you were even born. Whether or not you would go to heaven, that was determined by God. And there was nothing you could really do about it. And you just had to see if the fruits of the Spirit, you know, right, the kind of the signs that you were of the elect would appear. And so a lot of these churches would force congregants, church members, to stand before everyone and recite verses. And if they stumbled, you know, it was a bad sign. So I think it was much more strict in some ways. It's just, you know, things change, but they stay the same. It's like what people decide are the most rigid doctrinaire questions are they shift over time, but they're still there. You know, in my dad's church, he doesn't believe that we should drink, you know, anything, including wine, even though it's all over the Bible, including in the miracle at Cana, the wedding feast where Jesus turns water into wine. You know, people pick and choose what they want to believe and how they interpret the Bible over time. So that didn't change.
I remember when you were on with us regarding Boy Erased, and you talked about that you almost wrote about that character in the third person, that it was removed from you in a way. It was a fictional character, even though it was you. Did this feel different in writing about these characters?
You know, what's funny is it's this book, this fiction is almost more autobiographical than Boy Erased in some senses. Some of the thoughts that I've had over the years, I placed in some of these characters, and I had that screen of fiction to protect me. There are conversations I've had with people that are almost verbatim in the book, you know, filtered through 18th century language, but they're very much similar to conversations that I've had with people. And I don't know, fiction was much harder for me to write, but in some ways, Boy Erased, you know, it requires, when you're writing memoir, it requires a kind of persona that is stable and not full of contradiction, really, because you have to, you know, trust the narrator much more. And in fiction, where you're rotating through a cast of characters, and this book really explores not only these two men in love in the 18th century, but also their families who are dealing with this. You're sort of allowed to have a bit more friction and have some disagreement even in the narration that I wasn't allowed to do in Boy Erased.
And it seems like you look at different aspects of your life and of yourself through the characters that populate the novel.
Oh, for sure. It was funny because each draft a different character would kind of take over, and I would think it was a mistake. You know, at first I would think, oh, this is a bug, but it turns out that the book wanted to be sort of kaleidoscopic. You know, you're following a character for quite a while, and then another character comes on stage and almost contradicts what you'd started to agree with the other character. And that was what was fun about writing fiction is, I would side with the character when I was writing them, but then I'd dive into the other character and suddenly be angry on their behalf. So that was really fun.
The name of the new novel is All the World Beside. It is published by Riverhead. Garrett Connolly is our guest on this week's book show. In that writing process, do you find yourself rethinking or looking at faith, religion, spirituality in a different way?
Well, I think my friends were a little concerned with my mental health when I was writing this book. I mean, you know, I've always said I'll end up in a cult one day because I was in one, really. Fundamentalism in that small town in Arkansas was such a, there were a lot of similarities to cult practices. And I don't mean to be rude to my former church in that way. I do think there was a great sense of community, but there was so much conformity, and if you stepped out of line, even in your political beliefs, you would be sort of punished for it or ostracized. In that way, I've always thought, oh no, that's deeply ingrained in me. What's going to happen? And, you know, sure enough, I was reading so much Jonathan Edwards and so much just theology and digging into Christianity and sort of finding my own feed on how I felt about faith. You know, we go through a lot in life. It's not been an easy 7 years. And I think I was turning more towards faith, and towards some sense of God, which I don't think, you know, anymore is restricted to Christianity. And certainly Christians have given it a bad name for a long time. But I do think I've returned to a very solid sense of belief in God, which I'm honestly very shocked to say right now to you. And I think part of it came from just really digging into some of the trauma that I had experienced in the church and speaking to a lot of people who still had faith, and I would go do book events for Boy Erased or when we were doing promotion for the film, and I would meet so many LGBTQ Christians who would say, thank you so much for not trashing my religious experience. Like, I believe I fit in here. And that really inspired me to think a little bit wider about how faith could fit back into my life.
You certainly have every right to be angry. Do you feel that anger, and do you harness that anger in the writing?
I mean, sure. I think we have to channel anger into something like art or, exercise, some way to exercise it where we don't hurt people. I truly believe that anger is a corrosive force. It can also be a powerful force, but if you steep in it, if you just sit with it for too long, it turns into bitterness. And I didn't want that because I don't know, I can't walk through life being angry. It's too much energy. It takes away from creativity. And honestly, since you mentioned the Scarlet Letter earlier, there's a beautiful sort of metaphor for all of this in Hester Prynne, who's forced to wear the Scarlet A on her chest. She's given this sentence and she decides to turn this letter that is supposed to shame her into something so beautiful with her needlework and her art that everyone in the town who won't even look at her in the street wants her designs, like on their collars, and the magistrates want, her to do some of their designs. And I think that's a beautiful metaphor for art. We might feel anger and shame, but we can transform that into something beautiful and find our place within the world, even if it's still hard.
Can you talk a little bit about the research in the sense of looking at the tension between religion and sexuality, and that evolution that you write about and explore, and I assume deeply research?
Yes, I'd grown up reading in college John Donne, who was one of England's best poets, and he wrote this poem called "Batter My Heart, Three Person God," which compares himself to a maiden who must be ravished by God in order to stay chaste. So you've got there from the very beginning a tension that has always been there between sort of the head and the heart, the thinking, rational part of the brain, and also the part that tells you, I must do this in the name of God because I believe this. And then the heart, which tells you maybe something different. I think I've seen this in my own life over and over again. A joke that we used to say in Arkansas is, if you want to date and you're gay, go to church because there's a lot of us in there. And we see these, and we see the dark side of that, right? And scandals that have overtaken the Catholic Church and recently the Southern Baptists. There was a huge number of cases of abuse within that church, and all of it was swept under the rug for so long. And I think when we repress ourselves to such a degree that we're no longer human, right? We're no longer in communication with our heart. I think that turns us into monsters. And I was exploring that through this book with the Great Awakening, which was the period of history. There were two of them actually in the 18th century that really sort of brought a subjective sense of religion to people. That, earlier it was just like Father God and sort of a distance. And then suddenly there was this bodily explosion where people were crying out in church services and they were, sort of contorting and doing all these things that you might see in a Pentecostal church today. And I thought, what an interesting time, right? Like to place a gay love story or a love story between two men. That just ended up being really great ground to explore this love story in.
I like how you introduce it because it's there, right? I mean, it is introduced to us in the sense of this is happening. That, so to me, was fascinating because these are all characters who obviously take their religion very, very seriously, but they're also having, in many different ways, real struggles with what they believe and what they are supposed to believe.
Yeah, I mean, I think all my characters go through it. It's, I hated to do it to them, but it just seemed logical. I mean, I've seen my own mother, who is a preacher's wife now. She wasn't always. She had to sort of conform to this view that people had of a preacher's wife, and I saw the cost of that. And I saw the cost to my father, who was constantly on call and constantly being watched, and my own self. I was scrutinized. His congregants, are nice to me when I show up now, which is good. But I know they talk about me, and I know they read what I write, and they're probably very scandalized. But I don't know. I feel a kind of mission to speak a different truth about religion and a different possibility, and to really honor the people that have been harmed by what I see as, modern day Pharisees, the people who are all about the law, but not about the love,
When it comes to the head and then the heart, that connection can vary, and it seems to be something that you want to greatly explore in all the world beside.
And I think I'll probably be exploring it my whole life. If I figured it out by now, how the proportions work and how to have them communicate with each other, I think I'd be much happier. One of the things that conversion therapy does to people is it tells you over and over again, in this sort of brainwashing way, that what you feel cannot be true, or it's wrong, or what you think or suspect is also wrong. And so at every turn, whatever your head or your heart feels in a setting like that, in a fundamentalist place like that, it's no longer valid, right? You cannot trust in anything in yourself. And I think, to the great frustration of my partners and friends, I think I probably come off sometimes as really cold or suddenly very emotional. And part of that is just because I don't know how to navigate some of that.
You just said of I would probably be happier. Have you felt happiness, or do you feel that I mean, obviously you've felt some form of happiness, but I mean a sort of a happiness to its fullest extent, or is it always going to be held back in some way as a result of the conversion therapy and the general upbringing?
Well, I do want to say, part of this book, when I was writing it, I did intentionally bring in moments of joy to sort of alleviate some of the pain in the book. And I do ultimately think it's a happy ending, which I never thought I would get to. But I think there's always going to be a cost to conversion therapy. I mean, I was lucky in some ways. I did 6 months of one-on-one therapy with one therapist, and then 2 weeks of very intensive therapy. And so, I mean, I know people who went through years of this, and even decades, and they are barely able to function. So I think I'm a little lucky that I wasn't there longer. But I always say conversion therapy starts in the home. It's like it's just there your whole life if you're a certain person, in a certain environment like that. But yeah, I think happiness is possible. I have to believe in that, and I have faith. And I believe that, not to be too Christian here, and scare everyone away, but I do believe that God's grace is possible always, and that we're able to be freed of some of our, either our ego or our pain or trauma, to see the light of God and to see the truth. And I believe in that very much. I've experienced it, and I think healing is possible for a lot of people, but it has to start with acknowledging the pain, and it has to start with, I think, in my case, turning that pain into art. I would love to write a fun page turner. Maybe that'll be my next book when I can get to it.
You mentioned the joy in the book. There's great humor. There are moments of great humor in the novel.
Yeah, I mean, I had some fun with some of the characters. There's one character, Deborah Inverness, who is just the gossip of the town. And I was able to be a bit witty because you're dealing with the 18th century, so wit is always important. And yeah, I loved some of that. And then, when the men are together, I think they're a little more playful. We have our children in the novel who grow quite a bit over time. I think of them as sort of the future of queerness. They're sort of analogs for what can be and what can be possible. And yeah, I think I had a lot of fun writing parts of it because I was like, am I really putting this in here? This is just the juxtaposition of some of these absurdly, I don't know, fundamentalist Christianity moments with like some intense, memories of sexuality are pretty fun to do. So I liked being a little scandalous in this book. I mean, I kept thinking of all the people that would read it and be totally scandalized, and but I also thought they shouldn't be. It
Right.
really isn't scandalous to think this way, to think that humans are human and we're part spiritual and part earthly. It goes to the heart of what the best parts of the New Testament really talk about.
I think you explore it beautifully in the novel, in the sense of what you were just talking about, as these characters, the two central characters, grow closer and more passionate. You very much look at the impact this has on the family and how difficult it is for them, at the very least, in just understanding.
At first, this was going to be one of those books that I think was looking only at those two men. But early on, I just started feeling that there was so much bigger of a story here. And I also know that I was drawn to that part of the story because I know that the decisions I've made, not that, obviously I didn't decide to be gay. That's not a decision, but the decisions I made to speak out about my family and to write about our experiences, they ultimately, took a toll on my family. It was a big cost. And I don't think that I did anything wrong, but I can't help but acknowledge that cost, right? Just as what they did in reaction to that or before that, that was a cost for me too. And I think that everything in this world that involves freedom has some kind of cost to somebody else, right? It doesn't mean that it's a bad thing to take that freedom to do what you need to do to survive. But I think that we tend to ignore in our very like 21st century, you do you, life is a journey. I don't know. Sometimes a lot of that stuff rings very egocentric to me. And I'm just much more interested in exploring sort of what are the costs when we decide to take drastic steps in our lives to really become who we think we are. It was a huge cost for my father to become a preacher in our family, and it's a huge cost for me to continue to speak out about what he did to me. But I love him and he loves me. And so I think that's really the secret part of this whole equation. It's not so secret. It's in the Bible all over the place, but people try to hide it, right? The only thing that really heals all of this is love.
In talking about secrets, I mean, you had all spent so much of your life feeling that need to keep secrets. I assume that just doesn't go away. You have to work on that a lot to realize that there is, to use your earlier word, freedom.
Oh, yes. I mean, the number of times when I just have been completely secretive with people for no reason, right? I don't feel any reason most of the time to keep a secret, but sometimes I'm just so used to it that I'm like, oh, they don't need to know that, or oh, this doesn't have to happen. And I've worked really hard in the last few years to just be as radically honest. And sometimes, it might annoy people for me to be that honest, but it's such a better way than just automatically keeping secrets from the people you love. But it is, it's part of growing up in that environment. It teaches you to not trust anyone around you. I don't think that people that are doing that always know that they're doing that to their kids, I don't think they'd want to create liars out of their kids, but it does make you feel that way. It makes you feel like everyone's out to get you because, I was outed in my hometown and no one really at the time came up and said, oh, I'm so sorry. It was more just like avoiding me. And when you have what feels like a whole town against you, it really does bring some trust issues. I'll tell you that.
You touched on this earlier, but I just wanted to circle back to it because it seems that you believe and I think you're right, but that many queer readers will be surprised that you are the one writing this particular novel?
Maybe they won't be, because maybe it's not as much of a departure than I think it is now that I'm talking about all this stuff with you. But I do think they'll be surprised at either by the fact that it's not just a what would I say? I guess it's not simply a gay affirming book, right? Obviously, it's meant. I wrote this for an LGBTQ crowd, and specifically LGBTQ Christians, but I think that it is, it's not just wish fulfillment. It's not just let's look in the past and find ourselves and feel good about us always existing. It's much more complex than that. And then I think other people that expect me to kind of become more conservative will find that I haven't. And I feel like people are waiting for that shoe to drop, as you get closer to 40 and you're a white cis male, it's like, okay, when is that guy going to turn against trans people? When's he going to start talking about cancel culture? And I am just not interested in any of that. I'm not interested in breaking up what I think is a growing and important set of acronyms. Sometimes it's confusing, but I think that we should be open to people's identities that feel that they're queer, and I think that we should stick together. And a lot of my work in the book and outside of the book is in sort of introducing people to the challenges that trans people are facing right now, especially with so many bills in this country that are anti-LGBTQ. We can't afford to split up at this moment. We can't afford to fight amongst ourselves. That's exactly what they want.
The novel is All the World Beside. It is published by Riverhead. Garrett Connolly, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for sharing with us. Congratulations on the novel, and I so appreciate you spending time with us.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. Your questions were amazing.
Garrett Connolly's latest is All the World Beside. It is published by Riverhead. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.